And thank you so much for joining me on another edition of Hank Unplugged. This is going to be the last episode of Hank Unplugged for 2018, but I wanted to take a moment just to thank everyone who has been a loyal listener of this podcast. I'll tell you, bringing these conversations to you continues to be one of my favorite ministry activities. It's absolutely amazing to me that we've already brought over 70 episodes of Hank Unplugged to listeners around the world. And I'm already looking forward to bringing you more of the most informative, interesting, and inspirational individuals from around the globe to wherever you are listening. And to ensure that you never miss a conversation, make sure that you have subscribed to iTunes or, of course, wherever you get your favorite podcasts. And make sure to leave us some feedback on iTunes or at equip.org. We love to hear the testimonies. And as always, if you're enjoying the podcast, head to iTunes, leave us a 5-star rating or a review, and in that way, make your contribution, play a part in equipping Christians around the globe, ensuring that these essential conversations are heard by those who need the most. Just one quick 5-star rating. This is by Holwick, who said, for anyone who is serious about diving deep into all aspects of the Christian faith, this is the podcast that you ought to consider. Hank hosts a wide variety of Christian leaders and thinkers from around the globe, engaging them in thoughtful, meaningful conversations. I have grown tremendously in my knowledge and understanding regarding historical and current events within Christendom. Thank you, Hank, for doing the Lord's work. And again, we have had quite literally an avalanche of 5-star ratings, and this is due to our mission statement. We have been faithful in bringing you interesting, informative, inspirational people directly to your earbuds. Today will be no exception. In fact, this is going to be one of the greatest podcasts. I can say that because I've interviewed my guest many times over the years. His name is Dr. Oz Guinness, and it's going to take a while to get through his bio. I'm not going to hit every point, but this is an incredible human being. He's the author or editor of more than 30 books, including some of my all-time favorites, Renaissance, subtitled The Power of the Gospel, However Dark the Times, one that I featured many, many years ago and I really loved, Fit Bodies, Fat Minds, another, A Free People's Suicide, and then the one we'll talk about most today, Last Call for Liberty, How America's Genius for Freedom Has Become Its Greatest Threat. This is an incredible resource, obviously available to those who support the ministry. Check it out on the web at equip.org. Oz has, well, he's addressed audiences worldwide from the British House of Commons all the way to the U.S. Congress. Big divide between the two. He's a senior fellow at the Oxford Center for Christian Apologetics. He's the founder of the Trinity Forum. Oz was born in China. He was born to missionary parents, and he is the great-great-great-grandson of Arthur Guinness. That is his claim to fame. If you spend any time with Oz, I suppose he's going to tell you about the fineness of Guinness beer. Anyway, the Chinese Revolution expelled many foreigners, and Oz was one of them. He returned to England, where he was educated, earned his doctorate at Oxford University, and he was, among his many accomplishments, a lead drafter of the Williamsburg Charter. We'll talk a little bit about that later on. This celebrated the First Amendment. He has also been senior fellow at the East-West Institute in New York, where he drafted the Charter for Religious Freedom. He co-authored the public school curriculum, Living with Our Deepest Differences, and lives with his wife, Jenny, in Virginia, near Washington, D.C. Oz, great to have you on the podcast.
Hank, it's always a delight. Thank you.
Yeah, well, I tell you, we have loved your book, your latest book, Last Call for Liberty. In a strange sort of way, it is a wake-up call to all of us, and we've been promoting that quite actively on the Bible Answer Man broadcast. I want to start talking to you about your experience in China, and maybe you can give us a bit of your perspective on what the state of China is today.
Well, sadly, it wasn't too long ago where people thought the combination of capitalism and technology would really see an opening up of China. And that was the sort of sense after Jiang Zemin. But now under Xi Jinping, you can see an incredible campaign to stamp out all alternative sources of authority, whether it's the persecution of the church or the repression of the Uyghurs, the Muslims in Western China, with these re-education camps. So China is going through a very, very dark spell at the moment. But of course, the church has faced worst, and I'm sure they will survive, and the blood of the martyrs will be the seeds of even greater things.
Yeah, I don't think there's any question about that, but it is shocking to me. I've spent a lot of time in China over the last 10 or 15 years, and it seemed that the doors for the gospel were wide open. Now the persecution, as you alluded to, is pretty dramatic. And you're right, the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. But look at what's going on with respect to persecution around the world. I think about what's going on in the Middle East or in the Levant, squarely in the blind spot of the West, but some of the oldest Christian communities in places like Iraq, Mosul, virtually wiped out.
No, you're exactly right. And those are the two worst, I think, in the world. And then, of course, you have Nigeria and places like that. So things are a really bad situation. So wherever people are persecuted today, Christians are persecuted. And there's the irony. We're the pioneers of religious freedom. Sadly, in the medieval ages, we were the perpetrators of some of the worst violations against it. And now in the modern world, we're the most persecuted faith in the entire world. So it's a tough world, and you can see here in America with the LGBTQ activists tightening down, the discrimination against Christians is strengthening here. So these are challenging times, no question.
One of the things caught my attention, Oz, is your public school curriculum where you're seeking to deepen appreciation for the principles of religious liberty, establish a strong civic commitment, and create opportunities for civil discourse over religious differences in public life. What I want to talk to you about for just a moment here, or have you expand on, is the opportunities for Christians like yourself and others to contribute in this way. How significant is it to have Christians on the vanguard of creating things that shape the minds of students at a very early age?
Well, I think we've got to do that, whether it's education or public life in general. But when I was involved in the Williamsburg Charter, the mid-1980s, I got death threats for about 6 months, but they came from the extreme Christian right, because the Williamsburg Charter gave religious freedom to atheists and Muslims and so on, to everyone. But if you look at where we are today, the real problem now is on the extreme left. So I think the Religious Freedom Restoration Act in 1993 was the high watermark of the old consensus. And even the ACLU signed on to that, and it was passed under Bill Clinton. And you think of the 20 years since 1993, and now there's a sea change, so the old ways are almost unrecognizable. And you can see that religious freedom is under threat in this country as never before, reversing 300-plus years of an incredible record on religious freedom. You know, in my book, I call it the three dark R's, but the worst of the three are those who I call the rebranders. And they've taken religious freedom, which used to be the first liberty for Americans, and they've rebranded it as a code word for bigotry and discrimination. And that's absolutely disastrous. And they're pursuing this in a zero-sum way. And we're in for a very ugly time, I'm afraid. But, of course, we've got to be faithful to our Lord, whatever the challenge is.
You talk about being in for a very ugly time. It seems, as you read through your book, Last Call for Liberty, that our republic, the American Republic, in your view, is now experiencing the gravest crisis since the Civil War. And you say that this crisis is as significant as what happened under the 20th century Soviet communist authorities, even as great as Hitler's National Socialism. I'd like you to expand on that, because that's an incredible statement.
Well, the U.S. led the forces that overcame first the Nazis and then the Soviets. In other words, the master race and the master class. But now the challenges are not external. There are external challenges, the rise of China and so on. But the real challenges today are internal. And that's why it's so deadly, because it's coming internally from Americans. So there's no question that America's as deeply divided as at any time since the Civil War. But the question is why? You know, some people just see a rise in incivility or another episode of left against right. Or going deeper, people say, well, it's the coastals, New York, California, over against the Heartlanders in the flyover territory, the Midwest, and so on. And then others, and I think this is the deepest of the alternative explanations, they say it's the nationalists and populists over against the globalists, people like George Soros. All of those have something to say for them. But my argument, as you know in the book, is that the deepest, deepest division is far more important than any of those. It's those whose understanding of the American Republic, and above all of freedom, go back to the American Revolution, which was decisively, although not consistently, Christian through the Reformation. And those whose understanding of America and freedom go back, often without their realizing it, to 1789, the French Revolution, the French Enlightenment, and the ideas that have flown down from them. And you can see those are two very different revolutions. If you put that in biblical terms, since we're people of faith, Hank, you remember Paul says to the Galatians, who's bewitched you? This is another gospel you're following. Who's bewitched you? They've gone astray so soon. And in a way, what's happening in America, this is not another gospel, but another revolution. It's not the American Revolution. It's the French Revolution. And it'll be absolutely disastrous for freedom.
You know, you once said, and I've quoted you many times, and I don't know if it's original with you, but I usually give you credit, that contrast is the mother of clarity. And I think that's the brilliance of this book, the continuing contrast that you make between what happened in 1776 and the American Revolution, and then what happened in 1789 and the French Revolution. But one of the things I fear the most, and this again underscores the need to read the book, is that people are largely historically illiterate. So they see Les Mis and the French Revolution being glorified in some sense, and they think this was a good thing as opposed to being something that had dramatic ramifications, not only for France, but for the world.
No, absolutely. No, you're exactly right. We romanticize revolution because of Les Mis. Actually, that's the 1830s revolution, not even the French Revolution. But you're right. If you look, the English Revolution, which failed, and the American Revolution, which succeeded gloriously, were both biblical through the Reformation. But the French Revolution, and then the Russian Revolution in 1917, and the Chinese Revolution in 1949, were decisively anti-biblical and anti-religious. And they come really from the French Enlightenment, not from the Bible in any way. And they both produced reigns of terror. I mean, all three of them did. And they produced killing fields, sadly, and maybe 2 million killed in the French Revolution, upwards of more than 30 million in the Soviet Revolution, and maybe even as many as 75 million under Mao Zedong in the Chinese Revolution. And so we've got to get people to think historically and think biblically. I mean, the sources are quite different, the Enlightenment and the Bible. the views of humanity are different. I mean, the American Revolution has its core, the idea humans are fallen, so you need checks and balances, separation of powers, which, of course, goes back to the scriptures, the monarchy, the priesthood, and the prophets, and so on. And you can see, if you go all the way down the line, the differences are incredibly different, and they make a difference. And it will quite literally spell the end of the American Republic if the ideas from the liberal, left, progressives, and so on prevail.
I was thinking as you were speaking of this moniker that the pen is mightier than the sword, and Jean-Jacques Rousseau wrote this discourse on the origins and foundations of inequity among men. I think it was back in 1750 or 1755. And that actually was responsible in many ways for inspiring the ruthlessness of the French Revolution.
No, that's right. But whenever you have utopian ideas, you know, his idea, man is born free, but everywhere is in chains. You just got to remove the repressions, whatever they are, and then we'll all be happy, free, and fulfilled. Well, when you have utopian nonsense like that, unlike the American Revolution, you have to fill in the gap between the ideal and the real, and it's always filled in with coercion and violence, which is why so many of the utopian revolutions are the harbingers of the worst evil. In other words, there's two main sources of evil in the world. One are the dualists, people who see things as we, they, we're good, they're bad, as if there's no fallenness in us. But the really worst evils come from utopians. And Mao Zedong was a utopian. Rousseau was a utopian. And you can see that utopianism, say, in the sexual revolution. Just remove the repressions, bring sex education down to three-year-olds, etc. And as Wilhelm Reich and others said, we'll all be happy, free, and fulfilled. And he actually says that we can all have 5 orgasms a week, is his suggestion, then we'll clearly be unrepressed and we'll be happy. And this is just utopian nonsense.
I love your subtitle, How America's Genius for Freedom Has Become Its Greatest Threat. And I want to expand on that a little bit in our conversation by an anecdote. I was just in California as a result of my cancer treatment. I have ligaments that are a little brittle, you might say. And so I was looking at some products that might help that. And someone told me about a particular cannabis ointment. At any rate, I looked into that, had a conversation with someone who was a specialist on this via text. The next thing I know, I have all kinds of email messages letting me know about products like this. In other words, someone is monitoring my texts, and as a result of something I say or a word that's on my computer or on my smartphone, I get all of these advertisements. So here you have, well, the genius of freedom on the one hand, but on the other hand, that becomes a huge threat to your privacy.
No, that's right. But it's the almighty algorithms which have picked you up. I don't think there's any individual watching you, but the almighty algorithms have spotted the patterns of your searches and so on, and you'll be besieged to those for quite a while. And sadly, that's true of all of us. Now, of course, when you move in this country, that's mostly commercial, although the political potential of that is very damaging. But I don't think it's gone too far here. But if you move to China and you see their notion of social credit and how you can't travel, you can't do this, that, and the other, if you you fall foul of the authorities. You see something, technology has incredibly totalitarian implications if we're not very careful how to use it.
I want to talk a little bit about France in the present, get your perspective on, you know, the riots and the migration without assimilation, which I've often likened to the python swallowing its prey with a long and slow digestion. Not original with me, but I think it's very apt description of what's happening with the lack of assimilation that's taking place in places like France. What's your perspective on what's going on with the riots right now in France?
Well, sadly, they are reaping the folly of the globalists and their notion of a borderless world, because that undermines the identity and unity of a people. Now, well, then let's take America. America's a nation by intention and by ideas, and underlying everything are beliefs. It's not just come here and have a good time or have economic opportunities, but there used to be a melting pot. People would come from Europe, say, where they thought of the past, and through civic education, the melting pot, they became Americans and had beliefs not tied by blood, and they thought of the future. Now, in other words, to have that, you've got to have civic education. You've got to teach citizens what it means to be in a country like this. You just have everyone flooding in. Eventually, you undermine both identity and unity. And, of course, that's happened in spades in Europe with Angela Merkel's disastrous you-all-come policies. And naturally, there's a backlash against it. In the name, sometimes it can be ugly, nativism and nationalism, rather than the genuine patriotism, but the folly of the progressive left and so on is just disastrous. A borderless world would mean the end of America. Now, the trouble is here, President Trump is right. You've got to have identity, walls, and so on. But it isn't just walls. You've got to bring the people who come into the country, whether newborns or immigrants, you've got to teach them what it is to be American. Otherwise, immigration puts more of a stamp on America than the revolution. So both here and there, you've got the problem. Now, of course, in countries like France, you have an additional thing of incredible taxation. So I was talking to a French woman last night, my wife and I were, and she said, we lost over 50% of our paycheck every month through taxation. And it's absolutely absurd. So it's above all a reaction against the globalism and notions like the borderless world. There's also factors like extreme taxation and reaction to the bureaucrats in Brussels.
Talk about this from a personal standpoint. You oftentimes call yourself a visitor, and you have this visitor's perspective on what is happening in America. You were born in China, educated in England. I was born in Holland, and we immigrated first to Canada and then the United States. But there seems to be something about American freedom that is particularly precious to people like ourselves.
Well, you see things freshly when you see them from the outside, I think. You know, what, I can't remember the exact quote by Rudyard Kipling, what knows he of England who only England knows? In other words, you see your own country best when you see it from the vantage point of an outsider's perspective, and many Americans simply don't. Then you add what you said earlier, the lack of history and the mediocrity of education and the collapse of civic education. The notion of a pluribus unum, of teaching citizenship, it's completely gone. And, of course, that's one of the things that goes right back to the Old Testament. You had to pass it on from generation to generation, parents to children, teachers to students, or faith, and for us equally freedom, would die. Transmission's absolutely essential. It's gone in America. And that's why the Republic is in serious danger.
I think that is such an incredibly important point. And I don't remember if this was in your book. I think it was Jacob Neusner who said that civilization is suspended from generation to generation. I think he called it the gossamer strand of memory. And if one cohort of mothers and fathers fails to convey to its children what it has learned from its parents, then the great change of learning and wisdom will snap. In other words, you'll have the collapse of the whole edifice of knowledge and understanding. And this is, I think, one of the most important warnings that we need to pass on the values that we have as Christians to our children. I mean, you have this mass exodus of children out of the church, and part of it is because parents have abdicated their responsibility, as have churches and schools.
No, you're exactly right, Hank, and we need to say that loud and clear. And, you know, I was reading Jonathan Sacks, Lord Sacks, Rabbi Sacks, who was the chief rabbi of Britain, and he said, the constant question I had as chief rabbi, will we have Jewish grandchildren? In other words, the transmission, the handing on, the passing on of the baton is absolutely essential. And it's for the Jews, they rightly understood that schooling is more important than the army. And that's true for a free society. That's also true for a faith community. Now, the freedom, it goes back to, you know, the French philosopher Montesquieu, who pointed out you not only need the structures of freedom, that's the law, the constitution, regulations, all that. You need the spirit of freedom. And you think, say, of our churches, you know, the notion of generationalism, the segmenting of generations, which is so crazy in the churches, and we're losing the sense of the whole body of Christ, the kids, the old people, we're all one in Christ, and so on. And there's so many foolish things happening in America, certainly including in the churches.
You know, you give one real big warning when you say that the debate about America's future is also a debate with respect to the future of the world. What kind of world our posterity will live in? Expand on that a bit.
Well, people don't realize how rare free societies are. If you condense the whole story of civilization into 1 hour, free societies only come in the last 5 minutes, and they're rare and they're fleeting. You know, it's the American experiment. Athens lasted as a democracy 50 years, no more. And America, 300 odd years, it's the longest running political tutorial in the art of freedom the world's ever seen. So if it fails, it would be a tragedy. But not only for Americans, it would be a tragedy for the world, because there's no one else doing it so well. And if Americans give up on all that it took to build the American Republic, it's a carelessness and an irresponsibility on the most colossal historic level. And that's why I, as a European, an Englishman, an Irish here, sometimes I just grieve with sorrow. And sometimes I just get mad internally. I'm outraged. You know, things are happening that are unrecognizable in the America. I remember coming here as a student the first time, and so on. And do Americans realize the stakes of what's happening now? That's my point.
I was just thinking about the fact that being in Washington, D.C., recently you look at the monuments, the glistening buildings from Capitol Hill, and you think that the American experiment is going to go on forever. But if you've traveled around the world, I was in Greece not all that long ago at the Parthenon, you realize that civilizations rise and fall, and sometimes with incredible rapidity.
No, you're exactly right. Now, you do find among the framers the realism and that sense of history. You find it, say, with Abraham Lincoln, as I quoted in an earlier book. He was so aware of what he called the silent artillery of time, assaulting the walls of the Republic. But today, exactly the time when people need to think about it, Americans just think it'll be here forever, which is absolute folly, because nothing lasts forever in a fallen world. The presence of sin, the passing of time, and the best of things disappear. We know that from Scripture. And so the folly of Americans today, not considering how you sustain freedom when it's not being sustained, you know, it's just incredible. You go to Rome, and you can just stand and look. You can see a bit of the ruins of the King's Rome, then the Republic Rome, Cicero, Cato, and so on. And then you can see, of course, the ruins of the Rome of the Caesars. But Rome lasted 800 years. And I think it was Gibbon who said he got the idea for his book on the decline and fall of the Roman Empire when he saw grass growing and cattle grazing where the emperors and the senators deliberated. And he realized the passing of time. And I look at Capitol Hill today, and there are very few people who have any sense of history or wisdom like that.
It would be good, perhaps, for everybody listening in to hear your contrast between freedoms, between negative freedom and positive freedom. All freedom is not alike.
Now, that's terribly important. And what the book is, as you know, Hank, it's a checklist of 10 questions for Americans to ask and see where they come out on some of these basic questions, whether they, without realizing it, are answering in terms of today's answers that come from the French Revolution rather than the American. But you're raising a question I raised. What do we mean by freedom? You know, Abraham Lincoln said in the 1850s, everyone's talking of freedom, but the North means one thing, the South means another. So we've got to say what we mean. And today there are different distinctions. The basic distinction is the one Lord Acton put on the table. Is freedom the power to do what you ought, or is it the permission to do what you like? Well, much American freedom is the second today, and that won't last. But you raised one of the deepest questions of all, which is the difference between negative freedom and positive freedom, which comes from Isaiah Berlin, the Jewish philosopher. Negative freedom is freedom from. No one's free under the control of anyone or anything outside themselves. You always have to begin with negative freedom. But that's only half of freedom. True freedom is negative freedom from, plus freedom to be, freedom for, positive freedom. And biblical freedom is the latter. It's both. So you look at the book of Exodus, liberation was not liberty. So getting out of Egypt is negative freedom. But as the rabbis say, it took the Lord one day to get Israel out of Egypt, but it took him more than 40 years to get Egypt out of Israel. And so liberty is a much wider, deeper, longer-term thing than just liberation. So you look at, say, the folly of evangelicals in the 1970s and 80s who were hung up on the born-again movement, which was liberation. It was wonderful, but it didn't lead to discipleship. And that's why so much of it proved very shallow. And so we need negative freedom, yes, but we also need positive freedom, which requires truth. And of course, in the postmodern era, that's not popular at all.
You talk about discipleship, and I think probably important to elaborate on that a little bit, maybe a lot, because in so many Christian homes and churches throughout the country, maybe I should say throughout the world, you have this sense of a transactional Christianity. I said a prayer, I have a card that gets me into heaven, a card that keeps me out of hell, and that's the extent of it. But the discipleship part of it is that you're born into a community of faith, and within that community, you receive the graces whereby you're transformed. So Christianity is never meant to be transactional. It's meant to be transformative.
No, absolutely. And that's one place where Nietzsche was absolutely right, not wrong, when he talked about a long obedience in the same direction. And of course, that's true not only of faith, it's true of freedom. We can't be free by ourselves. We can't be people of faith by ourselves. And you're rightly stressing the corporate, the collective, being a part of the Christian community, including the heritage of history down the centuries, and so on, the great community of the saints. So, you know, a great deal of the American church is incredibly weak today. I call it, this is the way I put it, there's a scandal of the American church. This is the one country in the West where Christians are a huge majority and yet have less cultural influence than tiny groups who are a fraction of the church's size. So wonderful groups that I love, like the Jewish people, less than 2% of America, or groups with whom I often differ, say the LGBTQ people. You know, they're less than 2% of America, and yet both of those groups have an influence on culture far beyond their size, whereas we, who are the majority in the country, have a very feeble influence on the culture, and there's something wrong with us.
Yeah, I think part of what's wrong with us is that we're separated. I mean, if you take, let's say, a pound of salt and you put it in a quart of water, that salt is going to make the water very, very salty. But the problem is that the salt is in individual little Ziploc bags, and as a result, it's not permeating the water at all. I mean, I think it's critical that, as Benjamin Franklin said, if we don't hang together, we're going to hang separately.
Mm-hmm. I agree. But we are the majority, and so I think if there's a revival and reformation and recovery of what the gospel really means, there truly is a chance to turn things around even now, although things are looking pretty serious. I argue this is the Rubicon years, in the sense, as you remember, Julius Caesar coming down from Gaul, if he crossed the Rubicon, which is the boundary with Rome in the north of Italy, he was declaring Rome a war on the Republic. And he hesitated for a long time and eventually crossed, and then the Civil War began. And you can see today that a huge part of America, the universities and colleges, the press and media, and the world of entertainment, Hollywood and so on, they've already been overtaken by ideas that owe more to the French Revolution than to the American Revolution. Now, if that sweeps the whole country, which it hasn't yet, that would be the Rubicon moment that would spell the end of the American Republic, and that would be incredibly sad.
You mentioned Nietzsche. Expand on that a little bit. A lot of people listening in, believe it or not, are not going to know who we're talking about. And I think he's a very important figure because, as you just mentioned, all truth is God's truth. And he had some significant things to say in a positive direction. But he also, as I think you've pointed out, criticized the Exodus as the event that undermined the power-based view of freedom that he promoted.
Yes, he called the Exodus slave morality. In other words, he hated the idea that the herd, as he put it, was replacing the hero. And he wanted the Superman, the Overman, to be the hero, not the herd. And so did the French Revolution, so did the Russian Revolution, so did the Chinese Revolution. They were all elitist in their different way. And so Nietzsche was explicitly against Exodus and the American Revolution because there's stress on ordinary people. But I always read some of Nietzsche. He is the deadliest atheist that we take on. But at the same time, he was always honest. If God is dead, which he believed, then no one should fool themselves that things go on as they went on before. And he couldn't stand what he called the progressive windbags of odious optimism. People who said, God is dead, everything's the same. No, no, he said, if God is dead, you've unhinged the sun, and everything has changed. So I admire Nietzsche, although he's certainly our deadliest opponent philosophically.
Give us a little history lesson. You look at the social experiments that took place not all that long ago. Think of what happened under Lenin 100 or so years ago. You have an angry revolutionary who absolutely decimates Russian culture, particularly the church. And that's not all that long ago. Pol Pot, I was in Cambodia recently and saw the killing fields firsthand. Marx's triumph of the proletariat, which led to Stalin's terror in Ukraine and so forth. So give us a little history lesson, because we're talking about epic events here today, and most people don't have a perspective of what can happen. In fact, I was just looking at a documentary on the plane yesterday coming back from California. Very interesting, Architects of Denial. You have the Armenian genocide, and very, very few people even know about it. And Hitler told us one war later that whatever he did to the Poles wouldn't matter because people have amnesia. They don't even remember what happened to the Armenians. So he thought, well, we can get away with this very, very easily because people are historically illiterate.
That's right. And we've got no value for the individual. I think it was Stalin who said something like, the death of an individual is a tragedy. The death of a million people is a statistic. You know, you mentioned, or I did, in response to you, algorithms. Algorithms couldn't give any interest for anything individual. Or you take, say, modern notion of utilitarianism, the greatest good of the greatest number. There is no high place of the individual today coming from any philosophy, any ethic, and even the Universal Declaration of Human Rights is under assault today. But the way I put it, the 18th century, the Enlightenment, said, yes, God was dead, but we could do better. You know, evolution would replace creation. Human engineering would replace providence, and so on and so on. And the 20th century has just called all that into question. So World War One, World War Two, the things you mentioned. Then in the 60s, you had the rise of so-called anti-humanism. In other words, the sort of Leonardo type of picture of humanity, they said, was a man, and a handsome man, and a European man, and they attacked it. And then you had post-humanism, those who tried to see humanity in the light of the whole of creation, not creation, but the whole of the earth, and above all, the animals. I read yesterday a Clemson professor who actually said in the New York Times, it might be a good thing if humans went extinct, because we're damaging the rest of the species. And then, of course, you've got the post-humanism, which is seeing humanity merging with technology. So the whole notion of humanity today, or human worth, is under very serious assault. And we're moving into the age of post-truth. You've talked a lot about that. And I think the new thing is post-rights. And that's equally significant. Post-truth, post-rights. So we're in a world where there's only two peoples who have a high view of human worth, Jews and Christians. And Rabbi Sacks says, you know, the Genesis declaration that humans are made in the image and likeness of God, that is the Magna Carta of humanity. I love that. And it's desperately needed today in this anti-humanism, post-humanism sort of world that we're now seeing come in. We are the champions of human dignity, and we better stand firm. And we need to know why.
I thought it was brilliant in your book to talk about the Pledge of Allegiance, the national anthem in the NFL. You talked about it and Trump talked about it. But what is the significance of standing during the national anthem? A lot of people, they don't know that there's a very great significance to body postures.
Well, the anthem and the flag and the Pledge of Allegiance all refer to the founding documents of this country and, above all, the Declaration of Independence. So you have someone who is a great American like Martin Luther King, or Lincoln earlier, and Martin Luther King argued the Declaration was a promissory note. It promised liberty and justice for all, but sadly it didn't cash it in. So the time had come to cash it in. So he respects the Declaration even as he tackles the evil. Whereas you look at the Black Lives Matter or the kneeling controversy, they're disrespecting the very standard that you're supposed to be appealing to. And the fact is that their impulses go back not to the American Revolution, but to a rather different revolution, postmodern enlightenement, and so on. And so Trump just talks a bit about the military and so on. He never ties things in with the founding first principles. So my disappointment with him, and I defend him in a lot of cases, he talks of Make America Great Again, MAGA, but he never asks what made America great in the first place. And it wasn't the army, and it wasn't the economy. It was ideas, ideas and ideals to do with freedom and justice and equality and so on. So people should be standing with great respect to the anthem, to the flag, and to the Declaration in order to fight harder for liberty and justice for everyone.
So your point is that if you take a knee, you're actually standing up for something else, which is what happened during the French Revolution.
Well, that's right. And they had a completely different idea of everything. You know well, Hank, you know, they didn't believe in God, so they trundled in a prostitute and made her the Marianne, the revolutionary symbol, and put her in the Pantheon as the new center of worship instead of the Virgin Mary, and so on. So the revolution, the French Revolution, was a deliberate parody of so much of the Christian faith that had been there before. But we have to say with sadness that the Catholic Church in France was so oppressive and so corrupt, it needed a revolution. And I've often quoted the cry of Diderot and the French radicals, you know, we will never be free until we strangle the last king with the guts of the last priest. So church and state, throne and altar, were one. They were oppressive. and in collusion, revolutions were off both. So that was half understandable. But the American Revolution, where faith was disestablished, it was left to the voluntary dictates of conscience, never had that problem. And so Americans don't have any excuse for going that way. They should learn from the disasters of the French Revolution.
And we need to learn from the Exodus as well. You alluded to this earlier, but I think it's worth expanding on the fact that the freedom envisioned by the American Founding Fathers had its roots in the biblical Exodus. And I would argue that you could talk to probably 80 out of 100 pastors and they wouldn't tell you that or couldn't tell you that.
No, I agree with you. You know, in the old days, people would say, where did American freedom come from? They would have said the ancient liberties of the English, Magna Carta and all that sort of stuff. But that went out, say, with the rejection of the WASPs in the 60s. And now we have a rejection of white privilege altogether. So if you ask most Americans, they'd probably say, where did freedom come from? Athens. But of course, it didn't. Athenian democracy didn't last more than 50 years, and the framers were very wary of Athens. Historically, American freedom comes from Exodus, and above all, the notion of covenant, which over time, through the Reformation, became constitution. And that root system is so wonderful, you'd think pastors would revel in understanding it, but of course, we've got to live it out today. We've got to ask, what was it about Exodus that was so important in the Reformation and then in shaping New England?
You've often used the phrase cut flower. I think civilization appended to that, but we live in sort of a cut flower civilization. So human dignity and freedom and equality and justice and separation of powers and all these kinds of things have been cut off from their roots. And if they're cut off from their roots, what is the hope of the civilization or our freedoms to survive? It seems that there's no hope whatsoever.
No, that's right. And, you know, cut flowers can look very beautiful for days or a week or so at most, but eventually they die. And you can see that our America in particular, but the West in general, is now increasingly a cut flower civilization. So we've talked a lot in our discussion about human dignity. That's a very, very crucial one. But the same is true of freedom. As you know, Hank, if we look at the cultures surrounding Israel in Scripture, none of them had a high view of freedom. The Babylonians, the Egyptians, even the Greeks, behind everything for the Greeks was fate, moira. And people think, well, of course, modern cultures have a high view of freedom. But in fact, if you look at, say, atheists, secularists, Spinoza, Marx, Freud, Watson, B.F. Skinner, Jacques Monod, or come down to the new atheists like Sam Harris, Harris's book has a puppet on the front in strings. So if you can only use naturalistic science to see what man is, well, freedom is a fiction, as Harris says. The only solid grounding for freedom is the Bible. And people have got to wake up to this. We are throwing away our heritage. We're cutting off the roots. We're cutting off the branch on which we're sitting. And the folly of this is unbelievable.
It is absolutely incredible. And I think that one of the most incredible things is how people today no longer appreciate, in the truest sense of the word, how great, how brilliant our Constitution is. And as a result of that, we're falling for all kinds of pseudo freedoms as opposed to real freedoms.
No, that's right. Well, we're falling from ideas that come, as I say, from 1789. Now, I think we've got to analyze why that's happened. So you take, say, Marx called for a proletarian revolution. Never happened. So in the 1920s, Antonio Gramsci sat in jail under Mussolini in Italy, and he said Marx was actually not quite right. He was wrong. You win a revolution not through proletarian revolution in the streets, but through winning the cultural hegemony, that you win the gatekeepers, the dominant elites. Well, in the 60s, that was taken further by people like Herbert Marcuse here in America, And then in 1968, 50 years ago this year, Rudi Deutschke, the leader of the Red Brigade, I remember this as a young man, he said, we need a long march through the institutions. In other words, you've got to win the cultural hegemony by winning colleges, universities, press, media, entertainment, including Hollywood. 50 years later, they've done it. And those spheres of American life owe more to ideas coming from the French Revolution, 1789, than any ideas coming from the American Revolution. And that's the tragedy of where we are today. And I wish we had, the trouble is we don't have a Lincoln-like leader. So Lincoln addressed what he called the better angels of the American nature. And he appealed to the Declaration. And in that light, he tackled the evils of slavery. Whereas no one today, so far, knows how to address the better angels and to really bring in the founding first principles of the Declaration and the Constitution and appeal to them. And I've often said, in my 30-odd years here in Washington, D.C., I've only heard two political leaders, there may have been a few others, I've only heard two who've used history to address the present problems. So we have no Lincoln.
You mentioned Lincoln. Did he go through a personal progression on slavery? Because obviously he famously said that he who would be no slave must consent to having no slave, and those who deny freedom to others deserve it not for themselves. And yet it seemed that at the very beginning he said something very, very different early on.
Well, he was always opposed to slavery, and he attacked it for many, many years before he became president. But when he became president, part of his challenge was to hold the Union together. And people have quoted his remarks in that second vein as if he didn't care about slavery, but I think he did all along. And the quotations you use, which are much earlier, you know, they show that he was deeply concerned. He knew slavery was a moral evil. But, of course, he had the pragmatic challenge as president of holding the Union together. And so he didn't just fight the Civil War against slavery. It was to hold the Union together.
Yeah, so it was pragmatic. It was necessary at the time in order to accomplish the greater good.
No, that's right.
Talk about reparations. This is something I've always wanted to discuss with you. This big move on reparations, trying to right the wrongs of history, at least the perceived wrongs of history. In some cases, it seems very legitimate, like, for example, eugenics. Eugenics wreaked havoc on people, but yet the people who suffered are already dead, and they're... you know, their progeny in our generation aren't suffering the same things. Talk about how victimhood is a huge problem where you have victims seeking vengeance for this lengthening list of past sins, and that doesn't produce equality. It doesn't produce what it's designed to produce. It actually produces chaos, it seems.
Oh, absolutely. Now, come back to equality. That's a squishy notion in its own right. But take the idea of justice, which is so important. You can see a huge difference in biblical ideas of justice and French Revolution and its heirs and their views of justice. So part of the biblical view of justice, we both agree there is injustice, terrible wrongs, whatever they are. But in the biblical view, you address those, truth addressing power. You can call for repentance. There can be forgiveness. There are all sorts of ways that make a biblical view of pursuing justice very, very different. Whereas from the French Revolution, you're talking of postmodernism. There's no truth, only power. So that desire for reparations is often a power game. And you can see today that rather than solving the problems of injustice, that they're stoking them and making them actually even worse and perpetuating them more than ever. So you look in the past, and people like Frederick Douglass or Booker T. Washington or Lincoln, they all address the evils of slavery, but within a biblical framework. Whereas if you go from Martin Luther King to Stokely Carmichael, huge difference. And from Stokely Carmichael down to the extremes of Black Lives Matter, it's really a power game. And America's now irredeemably racist. And power politics comes in everywhere, in sports, in business, in everywhere. Well, it's going to be harder to solve than ever before. Now, you compare that, say, with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa at its best. It wasn't always perfect, but it really did bring healing to South Africa for quite a while. But we're now back to left-wing politics, which are really power politics. And then you add, you mentioned equality. The simple fact is we aren't equal. Some are fast, some are slow. Some are strong, some are weak. Some are rich, some are poor. Some are wise, some are dumb. Humans are very unequal. So the question is, how do you make them equal? Well, biblically, we're only equal under the Lord, as his children, and under the law. Otherwise, we're not really very equal. But if you make equality, like the French Revolution did, the ultimate principle, it always leads to an appeal to resentment and to an attempt to level. You level everyone down to the lowest common denominator. And if you put equality above liberty, you eventually lose liberty, and you end up with sort of a communism. All pigs are equal, but some pigs are more equal than others. So equality by itself is a disastrous notion. And much of the social justice warriors today are leading America down the garden path to a huge loss of liberty.
Yeah, I just love what you said. And I was thinking as you were speaking about Galatians chapter 3, where Abraham is said by Paul to only have one seed, and that one seed is Jesus Christ. And Paul goes to great pains to let us know that it's not seeds plural, but it's seed singular, that the royal seed of Abraham is Jesus Christ. But then you get to the end of the chapter, and then Paul says, if you are in Christ, then you are a seed of Abraham, or the seed of Abraham, and an heir according to the promise. And it doesn't matter whether you're Jew or Greek, slave or free, male or female, if you are in Christ, you are the seed of Abraham, an heir according to the promise. And therein, as you just said, therein we find our equality.
No, that's right. And you have this great stress that we who fight evil know that we have evil in our hearts, and we must never fight evil with things like hatred or superiority and so on. And you can see, I mentioned Booker T. Washington. He was born a slave, freed by Lincoln, but he says, I hate slavery as an institution, but I will never allow hate to come into my heart against a former slave owner or anyone like that, because then I would be a slave all over again. He was freed as a Christian internally. Which you can see in today's SJWs, you know, the perpetuation of hate and the perpetuation of division and so on, because it's postmodern power plays. Very, very different views. The trouble is, you just say justice, and a lot of young Christians will leap to their feet and salute, not realizing you have two very different views of justice, and one of them is disastrous.
You mentioned earlier on that you organized Last Call for Liberty around a checklist of questions, and one of those questions deals with the paradox of freedom, that there's an enemy of freedom, and that enemy is freedom. So we have a paradox. Unravel the paradox.
Well, you know, I stress that. A lot of people don't make much of it, but the greatest enemy of freedom is freedom. That's the dark paradox of freedom. And there are reasons for it. You can see how freedom becomes permissiveness, license, and then an anarchy, which rebounds into the opposite, authoritarianism. Or free people want to stay free. They want to be safe and free. They want to be secure. And then they have so much security, one nation under surveillance, they're not free. Or again, freedom-loving people, they love freedom. They prize freedom. So they'll do anything to fight for freedom, including things that contradict freedom. So again and again, freedom undermines itself. But the deep reasons for this, one of them is ethical. Freedom requires some restraint, what Edmund Burke called, we need a chain on our appetites. But the only really appropriate restraint for freedom is self-restraint. Freedom is obedience to be unenforceable. If you have to have external restraint, you're not free. But the trouble is self-restraint is what gets undermined when freedom flourishes. But the worst of them all, I think, is the biblical and the spiritual reason for the paradox. And that is that freedom requires responsibility. I'm free, I'm responsible for my words, my actions, but we'd rather not be responsible. In fact, the Jews say that at the heart of sin is an evasion of responsibility. You know, Cain, am I my brother's keeper? Or Adam, Lord, it was the woman you gave me who taught me to eat, and so on. You know, so we duck responsibility. But if you duck responsibility and become dependent, eventually tyranny looks as if it has a freedom in it, and freedom looks as if it's tyrannical because you're challenged to be responsible when you don't want to be. So these things are very deep and challenging, but there's a paradox of freedom. Freedom's its own worst enemy, and sadly, America's one more example of it all over again.
He who aims at nothing invariably hits it, and oftentimes we don't know what we're aiming at when we talk about freedom, but as you've pointed out, it involves human dignity and independence, and we have only two real civilizations that we can look to as exemplars of that, the ancient Jews and the Greeks.
No, that's right. Well, the Greeks, sadly, didn't last very long. They had that constant clash between the monarchs and the oligarchs and the democrats. And the democrats, Plato always thought democracy would end in tyranny because he had seen democrats execute his great hero, Socrates. So we should be, people think that freedom and democracy go hand in hand, and they certainly are close. But you can't put your trust in democracy by itself. You know, as the Jews point out, democracy has zero social content. All it tells you, who's supposed to be the ruler? The rulers are us. Whereas republicanism, in a covenantal or constitutional form, is rich in social content. So the Jewish notion that every Jew is responsible for every Jew, you love your neighbors yourself, and so on. There are principles there that need to be recovered today. We talked earlier of schooling, you know, the way Moses talked about children. And so the Jews were an intergenerational project. And Moses says at the end of his life, it wasn't just those of you who were there at Sinai, but those of us who've been born since then. In other words, those born and those unborn, they were all part, and you know that well, in a Christian sense. We have this great communion of saints. And once again, we need to know the history of the early fathers and the medieval church and the Reformation and the 18th century. Yet many Christians in America today have zero sense of history, whether it's faith or whether it's America.
Or language. You think about monikers that we use all the time, and people really don't know what they mean. Maybe you can cash out a couple of them for us. We talk about a constitutional republic or a liberal democracy, and people say liberal democracy, even in Christian circles, wait a minute, are you conservative or are you liberal? Not realizing that liberty has to do with liberties and freedom. So when we talk about a liberal democracy, we're using liberal in a very narrow sense.
That's right. I mean, there's all sorts of the German Democratic Republic. That was East Germany and communists. So the word democrat can be enormously twisted and distorted. And so liberal democracy is very important. But of course, the word liberal has been changed too. It used to mean free and generous. And if you look at 19th century liberalism, say John Stuart Mill, not a Christian, but a great liberal, he would say it's the freedom of the individual protected against the encroachment of the state. Whereas that was shifted in the 20th century, so liberal now means the promotion of freedom through the state, and those who can grab the levers of power in the state can advance their particular notions of freedom, whether it's transgenderism or whatever. A very, very different view. So everything today needs definition, and we need to argue for the best use of the terms and the real thing, because there are various false and specious notions trotting around that need to be challenged very robustly.
Another of your checklist questions has to do with how America's current views of freedom allow Americans to handle the challenge of modern diversity. How are Americans to handle disagreement and opposition from their fellow Americans? How can we promote civility?
Well, I would argue, and have done elsewhere, that when you have highly diverse countries, and you know the notion, everyone is now everywhere, media, travel, migration, never has the world been as diverse and pluralistic as it is today. So the Roman Empire was incredibly diverse, but it was Mediterranean, whereas now almost the entire world is. Well, you can't handle that unless you grant freedom of religion and conscience to everyone. And that, of course, is what's being roundly challenged by people on the liberal left today. And I mentioned the three dark R's. I mentioned one of them, the rebranders, those who are saying freedom of conscience is now a code word for bigotry. But the other two are worth noting, too. The first dark R are the reducers, those who said freedom of religion and conscience is merely freedom of worship. In other words, whatever you believe, between your 2 ears, as long as your mouth is firmly shut and you stay at home. So even the Chinese grant freedom of worship as they destroy in the last 2 weeks hundreds of churches. That's not religious freedom. Religious freedom is the right, you look at the Universal Declaration, Article 18, the right to adopt, to practice, to share, to change your faith. It's a comprehensive right. The second dark R, the removers, and you can think of the new atheists like Richard Dawkins and others, they say, well, look, we can see the ugly face of religion in public life. We've got to remove it. So for many in America today among the elites, religious freedom is freedom from religion, not freedom for religion, a very fateful difference, but an absolute disaster. So we're losing the civil public square rapidly, which means the loss of identity, the loss of unity in America, and the increase of tribalism and culture warring and various things that are all sapping the strength of the American Republic.
So there's something wrong with tribalism, but you probably wouldn't say there's something wrong with tribes. I mean, there's nothing wrong with having identities. The problem is when you have a tribalism which won't allow civil discourse.
No, that's right. But for instance, Americans used to be highly individualistic. And you think of the melting pot. People thought in Europe in terms of groups and kinship and blood. They came to America, civic education, the public schools, and they became individual citizens, the American dream, and so on. Well, Horace Kallen introduced multiculturalism in 1905. And when he first did, it was rejected by liberals. It really wasn't until the 70s it became the liberal ideology. But multiculturalism put a stress on groups, not the individual. You can't change your grandfather, so you take groups seriously, and ethnicity is, as he put it, unmeltable. Well, we are members of groups, but the loss of the focus on the individual is what's so damaging. And that produced, in turn, victim politics, identity politics, tribal politics, and all the new groups, not just the old ones, say Italians or Irish or whatever, but sexual orientation, and then the generational groups, the millennials, and so on. And so America now is all tribal identities. This, again, is disastrous, because we've lost, on the one hand, the notion of the common good, and we've lost, on the other hand, the notion of the primacy of the individual.
Which worldview, and this is one of your checklist questions as well, is the best and surest foundation to freedom? Obviously, a bit of a rhetorical question here, but part of what I'm driving at in asking you to discuss this is that paradigms only allow us to see what paradigms allow us to see, and we don't think as much about our paradigm as we think with our paradigm. We're stuck in this a psycho-epistemological cocoon. We're stuck in our linguistic hall of mirrors. We can't get outside of that. And there has to be a breakthrough in this area if we're really going to reestablish freedom as the founders intended.
No, that's right. But as you know, while we are within our paradigms, and they help us to see some things better and other things worse or not at all, you can see today, as Richard Weaver said, ideas have consequences, and as people have added in our time, and bad ideas have victims. So if you, I mentioned earlier, if you take freedom, who gives a philosophical grounding for freedom? Only the Bible. Who gives a high view of human worth? Only the Bible. And if you go on down the line and really answer, where do we see the grounding of some of these things? It's beginning to matter. For those of us who are Christians who understand it, particularly people, you and I love apologetics, Hank, we should be in the forefront of pointing out to people what they're doing. They're cutting off the grounds on which they're sitting. You cannot reject the Bible and have a high view of human dignity. You cannot reject the Bible and think that freedom will last because it now has become a cut flower, and so on. So the only solid grounding for some of these things, that chapter's on freedom, you know, the roots are in the scriptures. And if we reject the scriptures, there will be consequences.
But you talk about the Bible, and there are these looks on the faces of people of polite exasperation. I mean, after all, didn't Abraham try to sacrifice Isaac, and then you have Barack Obama say, we would call child services on Abraham if he were to do that in our generation. So people are so biblically illiterate, and part of the problem is not just saying, well, people have to get back to the Bible, but they have to learn to read the Bible in the sense in which it's intended, because people simply don't know the art and science of biblical interpretation.
Well, you know, we need a lot of help from our pastors. You know, as pastors...
The pastors need a lot of help.
Well, that's right. I read recently of a pastor, I shall leave him nameless because he's a friend too, that we need to unhitch faith from the Old Testament.
Oh, my goodness,
well,
yes.
What a stupid thing to say. And it'll make him look stupid in a few years' time, but the effects today are disastrous. I mean, arguing you can't understand American freedom without understanding the Exodus. And as we explore the Exodus and, of course, the whole of the Old Testament and the New, we have a tremendous rediscovery of great truths. I'm writing a book currently on time. You know, the biblical view of time and history over against, say, the East, where everything's a wheel and going nowhere, or over against secularism, where it's all up to us. And you have the optimists who think we can do it, and the pessimists who believe we can't. The biblical view of time and history and human enterprise is magnificent. And people who don't preach this great stuff are really letting us all down. So we need our pastors and preachers to do a far better job today.
You know, I want to talk about another antinomy that you bring up in the book, democracy and dictatorship. An antinomy in the sense that democracy can be as stifling as dictatorship.
No, that's right. So in other words, the word democracy, we've got to unpack and see what it assumes. I enjoy pointing out to people, you ask the average American, what's the most famous American statement on democracy? And they'll quote Abraham Lincoln and the Gettysburg Address, government of the people, by the people, for the people. Now, Lincoln knew, and historians know, that Lincoln was quoting. And many people forget he was quoting John Wycliffe. And Wycliffe was arguing in the 14th century, when you restore the Bible to ordinary people, they'll have the grounding to achieve government of the people, by the people, for the people. But without biblical notions and so on, you won't. And so even something like that, we need to really start a discussion of democracy, what it means. Want to say, the framers were very wary of direct democracy, Athenian style. How could you do that with 3 million people? Well, today we're 330 million people. But what does that say for, say, Californian referendums? or Facebook and its likes, and the expressive revolution where we feel, this goes back to Jean-Jacques Rousseau, what I feel is good is good. What I feel is bad is bad. Well, what are the implications of all those sort of things for democracy or our lousy education? You know, the 19th century often argued, if you expand the vote, the suffrage, you've got to expand education so that people able to vote are wise enough to vote. But if you have rotten education, mediocre education, or you have the complete collapse of civic education, what does that mean for democracy? I mean, democracy is sprouting with questions today, and we've got to have the courage to ask them and to see whether we're really continuing a democracy that is serving the purposes for which it was set up. And American democracy, sadly, is failing.
And I hear politicians today really alluding to mob rule when they're talking about eliminating the Electoral College.
No, that's right. Yeah, and if you just have majoritarianism, it will eventually become mob rule. So put it this way. I mentioned, you know and I know, we're in a post-truth world. Well, if there's no truth, everything's power. The end result is manipulation. It can be overt, Chinese style. It can be subtle, American advertising. Without truth, we're all being manipulated. But the second part is equally important. If we're in a post-rights world, the place of the individual, the primacy of the individual has gone. Increasingly, with manipulation, it'll be crowds, consensus, algorithms, statistics, 51, etc., will be in the world of the mob. And you can see today, increasingly, the left is using the mob. You take the Kavanaugh hearings, with the protesters beating on the doors of the Supreme Court. It was a mob. It was not an orderly, rational protest in any way. So we're in a world of manipulation and mobs. And as Christians, we've got to have our eyes open and stand against it and warn our fellow citizens, do they see what they're doing? The cut flower syndrome all over again in area after area.
I think we ought to wrap up the discussion with something that I was fascinated to reread in your book, Last Call for Liberty. It's the bitter joke. The bitter joke of Arthur Koestler, who used to hear, working in Berlin in the last days of the Weimar Republic, a mood of the time in which Hitler and National Socialists were plotting their path to power. And this joke was about a Chinese executioner. I don't know if you can tell the joke or not, but if you can, I think this is fabulous to end our conversation with.
Do you have it right in front of you?
Well, I mean, it's the story of a Chinese executioner. I think it was Wang Lun, right? He lived in the reign of the second emperor of the Ming Dynasty. And he was famous for his skill and speed in beheading victims. But all his life, he harbored a secret aspiration. He had never yet realized the aspiration of beheading a person so rapidly that the victim's head would remain poised on his neck after he had died. So he practiced and he practiced and he practiced. And finally, in his 76th year, he realized the ambition. It was a day that was very, very robust with executions, and he dispatched each man with graceful speed, heads rolling all over the place. And then came the 12th man. He began to mount the scaffold, and with a whisk of his sword, this executioner beheaded the victim so quickly that he continued to walk up the steps. And when the man reached the top, he spoke angrily to the executioner, "Why do you prolong my agony? You were merciful with the others." And it was the moment that the executioner had longed for. He now had crowned his life's work, and he had this sort of evil smile that spread over his face. He turned to the victim and he said, "Could you just nod your head?" And use that as an example for how quickly freedoms of native citizens of a country can evaporate. We're unsuspecting victims of what's happening in the culture because we simply don't know what's going on. We're dead before we realize it.
And Christians are so loving and sometimes so naive that they can think they're appeasing, but they're just feeding the dragon. I mean, I may be wrong on this one, but to take a current example. You know Nancy Pelosi's equality bill.
Mm-hmm.
She wants to put in gender equality, sexual orientation, in as an absolute right. Well, along with, say, religious freedom and so on. A lot of Christians have gone with what they call the fairness for all. So, yes, we'll put that in, so long as we are allowed an exemption for ourselves. Well, I think that's an absolute disaster, because we know they will press us in a zero-sum way. Take Baronelle Stutzman, the florist, and Jack Phillips, the baker, and many, many others. The LGBT people will not give up. If they get that right and it's put there right in the heart of the law, we may have an exemption now, but we don't realize it whittled down, whittled down, whittled down until it disappears. And I think it's just one current example of the naivety, certainly of some evangelicals. They think they can appease these people. You can't. Churchill well knew you can't appease Hitler. You have to take him on. And some of these things really need confronting with courage.
Well, I truly ask people to pray for Oz Guinness, that God will give him many, many more years of life to write everything that he writes. If I know about it, I read it. There's probably some things I don't know about, but everything he writes, I read it, and I think you should too. The book Last Call for Liberty, subtitled How America's Genius for Freedom Has Become Its Greatest Threat, is available to those who support the broadcast and the podcast, who support the ministries of the Christian Research Institute, our outreaches around the world. You just have to go to equip.org. We'll send you the book as you support the ministry. Again, check it out on the web at equip.org, or write me at Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. You can also talk to Resource Consultants, 888-7000, and the letters CRI. Oz, I deeply appreciate your work, your friendship, your brilliance in apologetics, the prescient way in which you write, and this last book. I mean, it's an amazing book.
Well, thank you, Hank. It's not only a privilege to be on with you again, it's always a joy and a pleasure. The Lord bless you and keep you in good health.
Well, thank you. I am in remission from my cancer by God's grace and the prayers of many, many people. So I went through a year of cancer, and it was probably the most productive year of my life.
Oh, that's wonderful. I'm just so glad. But thank you. A privilege to be on with you.
Well, thanks, Oz. And of course, our mission statement, to bring interesting, informative, inspirational people directly to you. If you've enjoyed the podcast, go to iTunes, give us a 5-star rating, and make sure that you share the podcast with others. This has been another incredible conversation with an incredible person. Check out Oz's books on the web at equip.org. Again, I have many favorites. I've mentioned a few of them, but they're all on the web at equip.org, available for those who support the Ministry of the Christian Research Institute. And with that, we are out of time for this podcast. Look forward to seeing you on the next podcast with more of interesting, informative, inspirational conversations. So long for now.